Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host today, Dr. Polly Shaw. Welcome, Polly.
Thank you.
You know, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Lee Daniel Kravitz, science journalist and author of a new book called Strange Contagion, really how the way we talk about health can spread like an infectious disease. Really interesting.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I know that this ranges anywhere from road anger to suicide to the positive emotions of hope and love and kindness. Really kind of these are pervasive things. But first, we've got some pervasive research that matters. And our very first one, let's just dive in, is about people who use kind of non-traditional methods only for cancer treatment. Not people who say, you know, I'm going to try to maybe do great things with my diet or other forms of massage with my radiation chemotherapy, but people who really just say, I'm only doing alternative therapies. What do you think about this? Because you take care of head and neck cancers and you must deal with this.
Yes, we do. And my sister's an oncologist, and unfortunately, she sees this more commonly than you would think. You know, we spend our days studying and researching treatment options for cancer, chemotherapy, radiation, sometimes surgery, but some people just don't want to do it. This statistic here really hits me. These people who turn down treatments in favor of alternative medicine were 2 to 6 times more likely to die within 6 years compared to people who accepted medically proven therapies.
Yeah, this was out of Yale School of Medicine, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and was looking at a large cancer database from 2004 to 2013 about prostate, breast, lung, and colon cancers. And they had 280 people who had used only non-traditional methods. And they were, you know, again, depending on which cancer it was, so breast cancer, they were 5 times as likely to die overall, 2 times as likely. And, you know, it's concerning. I think that you have to really understand and meet people where they're at. And these are certainly choices people can make. But I think giving them this data might help lead to better choices.
It really does highlight the importance of timely, proven care for cancer.
Yeah. I think that's something we could all agree on. Let's talk about this next research that matters that I'm going to really be interested in to hear your thoughts. You know, we talk about tinnitus, however we want to say it, that ringing in the ear, which I bet is kind of like high blood pressure to the family doctor. Tinnitus is kind of like to the ear, nose, and throat. It's what you see and what you do. And in this particular situation, they're talking about the relationship of serotonin. Huh?
You got it. It is prevalent. About 10% of the U.S. population is affected by tinnitus, and it is that high-pitched ringing in your ears. You know, for us, most commonly, it's caused by a little bit of hearing loss, especially the high-frequency hearing loss, which is the most common if you have had significant noise exposure for, you know, people who are working around machinery, heavy machinery, military occupations.
Led Zeppelin concerts when I was young.
You got it. You got it.
Sitting right next to that speaker.
Exactly. That's the most common. And this study shows that in these patients, if you are thinking about providing a medication, serotonin, which is a neuromodulator in the brain, there are medications, antidepressants, used to treat anxiety and depression that can worsen this tinnitus in the ear.
Which is, I guess, really concerning. This was actually in the journal Cell Reports, and this was looking at brain tissue in mice. So we have to say that, you know, the mice may not be the same as the humans, but I guess it suggests that we think about things that could make things better, and we could say, oh, this could be depressing and you might need an antidepressant, but maybe not using the one that affects the serotonin, because there are choices of lots of antidepressants if one had to use them.
That's correct. So, you know, it's like everything else. We got to talk to the patient and hear that they're having the tinnitus and how much anxiety that creates. It can be quite a nuisance for some people. And we definitely want to avoid worsening that anxiety from the tinnitus while trying to treat anxiety.
You call it tinnitus or tinnitus?
Tinnitus.
It must be a regional thing. I think down south, we want to get it down to one syllable.
I think that's it.
Tinnitus. One syllable
there.
You
got it.
Well, let's talk about actually interesting how one's thinking about something can affect how one feels about it. It's how you think about your arthritis. Can that make a difference in how you actually experience arthritis. And this was in research out of Penn State University on 135 adults with knee arthritis.
Yes, and in these patients, they showed that the people who remain confident in their ability to move end up being able to be more active than their less confident peers.
Really interesting. You know, we do a lot of work in family medicine and some of the research that I lead on motivational interviewing, where we help people change their behaviors for weight or change their behaviors for smoking and help them feel more confident. And really, we start off sometimes asking them, how confident do you feel? And if they say a 3, we say, what would it get you to a 5? And when they can move and make that, they're more likely to change their behavior. This suggests that that's a much wider phenomena. And no matter where you're at in your ability to function, if we could get you more confident in your ability to get to a 5, regardless of perhaps your physical ability, you actually will have better outcomes.
Truly underscores the mind is a powerful thing.
Yeah, this concept called self-efficacy, how you feel about your beliefs. And I think this is a major area of research. Really excited about it. I encourage our listeners, this was in health psychology, to take a look at it. Our last research that matters, Polly, is about high salt intake and heart failure. I think all of us, many of us, like our French fries. But for people with heart failure, boy, this really is potentially deadly.
This says high salt intake is associated with a doubled risk of heart failure, according to a 12-year study in more than 4,000 people presented at the ESC Congress.
Yeah, this was the North Karelia Heart Study out of Finland. We've talked about it on the show different times, a lot of good data that comes out of this. And they are able to follow these people now out for longer periods of time. And they were able to, through really comprehensive ways of understanding what different levels of salt intake in 5 different levels, and those who were in the lowest level, even if it was increased, still had elevated chances of dying. And those were in the highest level, it was significantly more. And so we really like most people to be less than the daily salt intake of 6.5 grams a day. And those who were 13.5 grams of salt a day had a 2 times higher risk of heart failure. The heart doesn't really like salt.
Yeah, and this is a really nice study, I feel. It's a prospective study looking at patients as they go forward of 4,630 randomly selected men and women from age 25 to 64. So we're really looking at, we recommend in this study, the optimal daily salt intake is less than 6 grams, a maximum really of 5 grams per day. And you really only need 2 to 3.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about unproven methods alone, not the way to take care of cancer, about how you're thinking about your arthritis may improve your outcome, about tinnitus and tinnitus and serotonin, and then finally about this whole area of heart failure and salt intake, not too much. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Lee Daniel Kravitz, science journalist and author of Strange Contagion. How we talk about disease and illness can influence how health issues spread through thought. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson, Dr. Polly Shaw. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's No. 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Polly Shaw. Today on Conversations, Polly, we're talking with Lee Daniel Kravitz, science journalist and author of an interesting new book called Strange Contagion, Inside the Surprising Science of Infectious Behaviors and Viral Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves and Many Other Health Issues and How They Spread Through Thought. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You know, I think we're really interested also because your path is in science journalism. How did you get interested in that?
You know, I started thinking about, I went into the profession of psychology thinking that I'd be a therapist. And one of the things I noticed in learning about psychotherapy and psychology in general is that everybody's focusing on the negative side of psychology. You know, depression, anxiety, PTSD, but it turns out there's actually as much, if not more, science behind the positive side of psychology. And that's what really kind of like sparked something new in me. And I decided this is something I really want to write about because, you know, we all know about post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's also something called, for instance, post-traumatic growth, which means that we do have trauma, but then we also grow from trauma. And there's science behind that. And all of a sudden, I realized there's this whole world of new psychology, behavioral psychology in particular, that is counterintuitive, but that affects us on a profound and very present way.
Yeah, and as physicians, you know, we're very in tune with infections and that diseases spread and they can become infectious. But this idea of infections of thoughts, infectiousness of thoughts, is what you are focusing on. And so your book is fascinating, and you start with this particularly tragic story. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You got it. Yeah. So I live in Northern California, and a couple years ago, back in 2009, my family and I moved to Silicon Valley. My wife got a job at Google, and we were actually about to have our first child. And right across the street from our apartment was one of the top public high schools in the country. And a lot of the kids who went there, their parents were part of the Silicon Valley, you know, structure, you know, innovators, you know, from Google, Facebook, HP, Stanford University. There was just a lot of innovation there. And tragically, right before my son was born, a student from this school inexplicably walked across the street to the train tracks and stood there and let a train hit him. And this was devastating for a number of reasons. Obviously, it was very tragic. But what startled everybody was that 3 weeks later, another student from the school did it again. And then 3 weeks after that, another student, and then another student, and another student. And over the last 4.5 years, there's been 10 deaths from this school. And, you know, as a science journalist, I was very obviously heartbroken, but also very curious what was going on. And, you know, people kind of attributed it to stress, like, you know, terrible stress, and the kids were put under a lot of pressure. But the truth was, it was so much more complicated than that. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that the science shows that it's contagious thoughts, contagious emotions, and contagious behaviors that come together in a perfect storm. And in some cases, can lead to good things. And in some other cases, can lead to things like suicide, like a rash of suicide. It's technically called the suicide cluster. So with this book, I actually set out to, one, uncover the social contagions that were contributing to this particular event in my town. In so doing, I actually uncovered, you know, dozens of these social contagions that affect us every day in life, whether we know it or not. And they affect healthcare, you know, businesses, education, all the way down to how we raise our own children.
You know, it's interesting. As a family doctor, I've had many patients and those of my colleagues, you know, who have attempted or in some cases committed suicide. And when you read about it, one of the advice we get is to, you know, be really careful of the copycat suicides, and you don't usually see these things publicized very much. Is that part of this infectiousness of thoughts? And what sort of behaviors and emotions then are behind this infectious nature of what may be, in this case, viral thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's two questions there, right? So it's publicizing and talking about it, something that makes it spread. And I'll give a great example. Back in Vienna in the 1980s, someone was going to work, and instead of going to work, jumped in front of the subway train there. And every day for the next year, other people did the same. So it was and every day the newspaper would shout, you know, another death, another suicide on the train tracks. And the Annenberg School of Public Policy did an experiment. They asked all media in the area to stop talking about this, you know, these suicides as they happen, and instead of making big headlines and sensationalizing it, to make it a small story in the back of the newspaper with, you know, non-sensationalistic sort of headline, and then also a 1-800 number to call if you're feeling suicidal. And within a month, the suicides dropped by 80%. So what that shows is that how we talk about this stuff matters, because if we talk about it and sensationalize it, it does spread. It tends to spread. But if we use responsible language and we use certain language, like instead of, you know, saying suicide in a headline, we say, you know, so-and-so died, you know, and then later on in the copy talk about how he died, and being, you know, using no adjectives and nothing sensational, that tends to bring it down. So media does spread it. So there's that. And specifically in Silicon Valley, what I found was that, look, we had contagions of fear, contagions of greed, contagions of hysteria, contagions of depression, anxiety, and stress. All of these things are carried by cues in the environment, reading how other people are behaving, or even look at, you can actually even see their thoughts. And the scariest thing I think about strange contagions in general, or social contagions, is that we don't even know that we've caught them.
Hmm. So how do you separate, though, the kind of how you study this? I think it makes it very complicated. You know, is it the media sensationalizing something versus an actual contagion of thought, or vice versa, the really increase in incidence of fear, depression, et cetera, because of some underlying
right.
thing that's happening in that area rather than just transmitting a behavior?
Yeah. It's a tough thing to study. And the truth was, I didn't even know where to start. So I started kind of basically where people were talking. They would say things like, it's stress. It's stress. Okay. Well, if it's stress, let me look at some other communities that are dealing with stress. Now, stress is like a really common thing. So if stress is so common, specifically in places like Silicon Valley or, you know, in Boston, for instance, or Austin, Texas, like stress, you know, these conditions exist everywhere. And if that's the case, why aren't more people reacting the way that the kids in Palo Alto are? And so to research it, I basically went to each of these places and looked up case studies to show, you know, okay, what are some other communities that are dealing with contagious stress? And how did they cure it? How did they deal with it? And then basically, based on that, I would bring all these findings back to Palo Alto and I apply it to what's happening here. And I kind of use it as a litmus test. Is it stress? Is it contagious? And if so, can we cure it and treat it the way that these other communities did with their, you know, these other case studies? And sometimes they led to dead ends, and other times they led to things like, yes, absolutely, fear is highly, highly contagious. It's something that in the worst circumstances can cause people to manifest physical symptoms,
yeah,
even though nothing is going on.
And we've known that as clinicians all the time, the diagnosis of anxiety, someone coming in with chest pain. And so I love this idea that we're going to expand the conversation to other emotions, that maybe just the emotion itself is the name and it's sufficient to have fear. It doesn't have to be anxiety or a psychiatric diagnosis. Yeah, I love that. We're going to take a short break, but then we're going to continue our conversation with Lee Kravitz about the surprising science of infectious behaviors, strange contagion. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Polly Shai. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Polly Shai. We've been talking with Lee Daniel Kravitz, science journalist and author of a really fascinating new book, Strange Contagion, Inside the Surprising Science of Infectious Behaviors and Viral Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. And we've been talking about the research that you've done to understand better how emotions become contagious. What's the science that's behind this phenomenon?
Sure. So there are a couple things going on here. So let's talk about the biology. You know, in our minds, we actually have something called mirror neurons. And what that means is we visualize or we see people who are crying, and our minds respond as though, you know, because we empathize, we start to take on those conditions as well. So a great example, if I were to yawn into my microphone right now, mostly every listener would probably get the impulse to yawn as well. Because we all know what yawning feels like. We all know, you know, there's a kind of contagious behavior element that happens with that. And we start to yawn as well. So that's the mirror neuron effect. And, you know, that's on a micro level. On a macro level, we can mirror violence. We can mirror greed. We can mirror hysteria or depression simply by seeing somebody else who is displaying these sorts of behaviors and emotions and thoughts. And when that happens, we inadvertently, unconsciously take these on. And these are responsible, by the way, for everything from wars and revolutions down to sales techniques. You know, people who know how to channel this stuff can actually use it to their advantage. The second thing is cues in the environment. They're technically called primes. So, you know, there's science that shows that certain colors will induce in some people or most people certain feelings or even behaviors. If there, you know, there's a researcher out of the NYU Motivation Lab here in New York City, and he's figured out that there are certain images that if he puts them on the walls, his students come in and they start to think differently. They start to think more meticulously and more purposefully, just based on these little things that he places in his office. We also know that, like for instance, the color red, there's science that shows that the color red will actually induce courage in people. So those are called primes. And the scary thing, and also I guess the helpful thing, is that everything can prime us. Everything can prime us. So in Silicon Valley, I always kind of bring it back to the story of Palo Alto. In Silicon Valley, you know, there's modest-looking homes everywhere, you know, dozens and dozens of modest-looking homes. And there's mansions as well. Those are the multi-million-dollar mansions. But these modest homes, because it's Silicon Valley, also cost millions of dollars. So if you're a student and you're just driving around and existing in these neighborhoods and you see these small houses that look like nothing, but you know in the back of your mind that these houses cost a lot, that primes you to start to think, I need to make a lot of money. I need to be successful enough to get a modest house. And if I fail at that, I am a failure. And so those sorts of things prime or cue us. And so those are the two things.
Well, on the positive side of what you said, I think the first point you made about, well, violence can be mimicked, et cetera, it kind of goes back to the age-old saying that lead by example, or that role modeling really truly is important.
Right.
You know, so it makes me feel a little bit better
exactly
about what we're
right.
doing. But
I should say that's exactly right. There's a lot of negative social contagions, but there are a heck of a lot of positive ones too. I mean, everything from courage to resilience, even hope and happiness. There's a study out of Yale that shows that, you know, happiness is contagious by up to 3 degrees of separation. That you can catch happiness not only by watching somebody else smile, but your next-door neighbor who happens to be in a good mood one day will actually translate that sense of happiness to someone who's behind closed doors in the next house. And there are studies that show how that's done. It's fascinating.
You talk about some other things in your book about health issues that you've learned that can also be infectious. And I think this goes back to what you were talking about, the mind-body connection. What physical ailments or health mm-hmm. conditions have you come across that you feel are also contagious in this way?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So I met a professor who was studying anorexia. Now, anorexia as an eating disorder has been around since the Middle Ages, at least. I mean, this is a really old psychological condition where people, you know, monitor how much food they take in and try to reach a kind of an idealized weight. And it's deadly. But back in the late 70s, he met about 7 or 8 patients who had come into his clinic who claimed to be anorexic, but they didn't have the same symptoms. Instead of, they were actually binging and purging. And he had never seen this before, so he decided to write a paper about it. And he called it bulimia, and the paper eventually was added, the diagnosis was added to the DSM-3 at the time, the diagnostic manual. And at the time that this happened, you know, a lot of magazines started writing about it as well, just kind of based because there was now a language for it, a term for it. And it was really fascinating. People were really curious about bulimia, what was happening. Now, this researcher all of a sudden started tracking the case number of bulimia, the cases, and they spread like wildfire. They spread across the world, and you started to see larger and larger and larger numbers of people diagnosed with bulimia. And here's the thing, because I asked him, I said, is this something that's always been around and we just are now identifying it? And the research team said, no, 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 no. what happened was they identified something new, and then other people caught on to the idea that this is something I can do. So bulimia has literally only been around for about 35 years, and it's caught by just a sense of awareness.
Wow. Wow. This is fascinating. It's kind of worrisome. When you were talking before, it made me think about road rage. And if that is one of the modern plagues of this contagion, and that because people have been driving forever, but this stress and they see and hear and you're primed for that in ways. And I thought about how years ago when I was in a leadership course, and I had this decision to make, should I try to be less angry or should I try to be more calm? And I chose to work on being calm, a positive attribute. I know you and your own work have included yourself in the narrative. And I wonder, how does this research, how did you react to it? And how did you change your own thoughts and behaviors?
Thank you for asking that. So the book is pretty much anchored in the story of, I'm raising my family in Palo Alto as the suicide contagion is raging. And, I worried, we all worried about our kids. And I had this thought if this is happening, I don't want my kids catching this thing that's going around. I know it seemed pretty unlikely, but, hysteria is highly contagious too. And ultimately, we wound up leaving Palo Alto and basically escaping. A lot of our friends did the exact same thing. They used different language for it. They would say things like, it's too expensive here, or we just don't want to raise our kids in schools that, the academics are too stringent. But they're all saying the same thing. They didn't want their kids catching whatever was going around. But as soon as I moved, a couple of things happened. One, I realized that I had bought into the fear. I had bought into the hysteria, and there was no reason to. While this does happen, there are lots of reasons why it doesn't happen as well. And as a member of the community, we almost have an obligation to watch out for one another, to understand the signs and symptoms of all of these contagious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions, and to watch out for one another. And if we see something, become what I call an interrupter, to identify that somebody's in trouble and know how to treat them, where to send them, where to find help for them. That's the only way to stop this. And I had made a mistake because I ran away. The other thing is, frankly, this isn't a Palo Alto problem. It's not a Silicon Valley problem. What I also learned was, what's happening there is spreading, very, very quickly all over the country, all over the world, really. You look at the stats, suicide in general, it's a increasing problem. But also, frankly, the positive contagions are so pervasive that you can't outrun this stuff. And the best thing to do then is to be aware of the negative ones and to be proactive in choosing to spread the positive ones.
So what's the immunization here? What's the vaccination? What's your prescription here for kind of the interrupter on a mass scale to help inoculate us from some of these things in the future?
Oh my gosh! So there are a lot. One, there was this a researcher named Sigal Barsad over at Wharton Business School, and a couple of years ago, she was doing a study on teamwork, and she was spending a lot of time at different hospitals around the country. And one hospital in particular seemed to have something unique. It turns out that every employee at this particular hospital had just high workplace satisfaction, and there was nothing different about this particular hospital. Hospital is a hospital, really. So what was going on? It turns out that they had something that's called companionate love. And the idea behind companionate love is it seems really simple, but the social workers and the nurses and the doctors and the practitioners, they were just kind to one another. If a nurse was having a really bad day or a hard day, another person would recognize that they were having a bad day and walk over and say, "Hey, how are you doing?" Offer a shoulder to cry on. Or better yet, if they were having a great day, the entire team genuinely supported that other person in congratulating them. That created this environment of just good mental health and well-being. But here's the crazy thing. That started trickling down by 3 degrees of separation. And not only that, patients who rarely had any interaction, did not see any of these, kindness interactions taking place, felt it. They felt the effects of this, and some of them lived longer. They spent, on average, shorter stays in the hospital. And not only that, but their family members also caught it. So we start to see that things like kindness or companionate love is sort of it's a vaccine for burnout.
Wow,
which is also highly contagious.
That's great.
It's incredible.
That's great.
I think this is fascinating. We could talk about this for hours. It can go in so many different directions. So be an interrupter. Be kind to one another. Are there any last final thoughts you have for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. A community and being a member of a community is really, really important here. The number one takeaway for being an interrupter for negative contagions, which are everywhere, is to be aware of the signs and symptoms and understand, you know, how to help somebody in need. Become somebody who spreads happiness, someone who spreads companionate love, shows resilience, shows bravery, understands the language of social emotional learning. All of these things make a big difference in inoculating against some pretty scary stuff.
Well, that's a great message, and we appreciate you coming to talk with your health listeners to tell us this message.
And we have caught that positive energy just now.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
We've been talking with Lee Daniel Kravitz, science journalist, fascinating author of a new book, Strange Contagion, Inside the Surprising Science of Infectious Behaviors and Viral Emotions, What They Tell Us About Ourselves, which we will put up on our blog, encourage our listeners to look at, get this book, and talk with each other about ways of spreading kindness and positive thoughts that can protect us all from these contagions. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Dr. Polly Shaw. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Polly and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Polly, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about someone who's having a burning pain in the pit of their stomach.
Recently at night, I've been feeling almost a burning pain in my stomach. I also seem to be more frequently experiencing other discomfort during the day, such as stomach upset or acid reflux. Do you have any advice?
Oh, we always have advice.
Absolutely.
You ask a doctor, you're going to get some opinions. Let's see. What's one of your thoughts, Polly? What do you first think about?
Well, I think these symptoms are fairly consistent with acid reflux. You know, you definitely want to make sure you're not having too much pain, really belly tenderness. Those would be more concerning symptoms. But for acid burning and burning in the middle of the chest, especially at night, some basic recommendations that can help that out are trying to avoid spicy foods, fatty foods, chocolate, caffeine, alcohol, tomato-based foods, and laying down on a full stomach. So we usually say about 2 to 3 hours after you eat before you lay down at night, and those things should help. Of course, when I tell people this, they say, you cut out all my good stuff. But
and we got to throw smoking in there because that's one of the causes of ulcers. But if it were an ulcer rather than just reflux, and you know, there may be some other things, and we have this organism, this H. pylori, and so getting tested for that would sometimes be helpful. Sometimes just lifting the head of the bed up, not going to bed so quickly and not eating late at night. These are, you know, some really simple things could be helpful. And I guess depending on your age, we know that things like heart disease are underdiagnosed in women. And so if you were in your 60s and you were having this kind of new onset, I would also just say maybe go see your doctor.
Absolutely.
Find out what's going on. So good luck. Hope that this gets better. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 5-year-old seems to be developing a stutter. We'd like to get her help as soon as possible, but we're unsure where to start. What are the first steps here?
Interesting question. I know you probably, because you work with our audiologist a lot, our speech and language therapist a lot. Tell us a little bit about, what do we know about stuttering? I think it's a great question.
So, you know, I'm a part of the UNC Voice Center, so we get patients with stuttering and other voice disorders in general. You know, stuttering is mostly articulation, the way we produce voice. We need our lung source or a generator, our oscillator, the vocal folds, and then the resonance, your head and face, and then your articulators, your mouth, your tongue, your lips. And that's usually where the stuttering comes from. So we're networking and finding a really good speech-language pathologist who specializes in that area is the best place to be.
Is stuttering in children something that they would have since birth, or how often would it be that they acquire it at a certain age? And then is that related to some experience that they're experiencing, some sort of stress or something external versus a physical?
I think we don't know that exactly for sure, but it's typically not from birth. It typically does develop. Some people grow up with an actual tic disorder and something more underlying that can't be completely broken. But the most common childhood stutter does develop in this age group and can be very well treated and overcome.
And what would a parent expect? How quickly would they expect to see some results if they went to one of these speech and language specialists? What do you think was realistic?
So in general, they try to do about a session a week for several weeks. So we like the continuity exercises at home and repetition and learning to kind of get your body to habituate in a better voice. So we can expect some results in about 1 to 2, sometimes even 3 months.
So this can get better.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we'll ask our health science librarians, our great friends, to put up some information about stuttering that perhaps the stuff that is that you all do use for patient education materials and that we can use to help educate our listeners.
Yes.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have eczema and often have flare-ups of it. But recently, a friend of mine who also happens to be a nurse wondered if I might ask my dermatologist about one patch of irritated skin. She suggested that it might be something called tinea versicolor. What is that?
Well, that's a great question, and they oftentimes say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And unfortunately, in dermatology, that's really true. So not having a picture here, it makes it difficult to sometimes say. But I do a lot of teaching in dermatology, and one of the things I oftentimes say is, and I'm sure you all in your ear, nose, and throat practice, you look for patterns. And if I were to say we talked about someone who maybe was clearing their throat and you happen to think of allergies and things that, you know, are common, well, a single patch of skin is not usually tinea versicolor. Tinea versicolor is this kind of these changes in pigmentation that are caused by a fungal-like organism, Malassia furfur. And typically people have – they look like kind of some parts of their body have too much melanin, some parts don't have enough, and they have these kind of areas of light and dark skin, and it's usually all over. So that pattern is not one suggestive of a single area of skin. Have you had an itchy spot on your skin, just a single itchy spot?
I have had the eczema in places that
right.
Itch in a little patch, yes.
Yeah, and eczema, that can be called numular eczema, coin-shaped eczema, these itchy patches, and that certainly can be a real problem and can happen a lot. And sometimes people in dermatology, they don't take a strong enough medicine. So they might have that numular eczema and they put some hydrocortisone cream and they went, it's not working. Well, that's kind of like saying I'm going to put a single ice cube on a large swollen area of the body. You need a whole ice pack. You need something, a stronger dose. Any other thoughts you have about what else we might recommend? Because they asked this expert, which a lot of times is helpful. I think getting in to see someone would be useful.
Yeah, I think, as you said, a picture's worth 1,000 words. So if there's one spot that's concerning and it's looking different than everything else and having some irregularities, getting it checked out by a dermatologist is definitely not a bad idea.
And one of the treatments for tinea versicolor sometimes is a shampoo called Selsun. The problem is you use that on eczema. May or may not make it better, may make it worse, and it could be irritating. So not so certain that would be the right treatment for that. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we really want to thank everyone for listening to Your Health. We hope we've answered issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. If you have any question you want us to address, you can send us a question or comment at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest co-host, Dr. Polly Shah, and our guest today, author Lee Daniel Kravitz. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Polly Shah.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.